Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
We want to start in Dorchester. Five men were shot at the Franklin Field development there last night. One died. They had been holding an outdoor birthday party. The Boston Globe identified 43-year-old Rolando Verdejo as the man who lost his life. The shooting was not the only act of violence in our community last night. A 17-year-old boy from East Boston was stabbed at Revere Beach, and on Massachusetts Avenue, one person was shot and another person was stabbed. Community leaders and police are concerned about the violence we're seeing in the city. Joining us to talk about it is Talia Rivera, Director of Street Outreach, Advocacy, and Response for the City of Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Talia.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So what's on your mind today after last night, Talia?
Oh, my gosh. What's on my mind? obviously, we have been strategizing and just trying to figure out, like, how do we continue to do outreach amidst this pandemic? And it's been something we've been dealing with and grappling with for the last 2 months or so. But it's rough. You know, it's rough when any person loses their life. The streets have been pretty hectic lately.
What's making it so hard to do your work?
Well, I mean, it's difficult, one, because of, you know, COVID-19 and all the different rules and, you know, regulations that have been put in place for us, the stay-at-home advisory, the practice in social distancing. And obviously, we want to make sure that our street workers are safe. So we have created a modified outreach plan so that we could at least be present. Because one of the things that we've noticed pretty early on at the beginning of this pandemic is that the young people were out. You know, the young people were out in parks. They were still playing in basketball courts. So it was, you know, virtually impossible for us to completely stay at home. So we had to come up with some sort of plan so that we could keep touching the young people that we service.
Talia, can you put it in perspective for us? We've seen a number of announcements and gatherings by community leaders and police in the last few weeks concerned about community violence. Are we seeing an uptick? Is there something more going on this year than in past years? Not that past years have been okay, because obviously no amount of community violence is okay.
Absolutely. I mean, to be honest, when you look at the data, no, it's not that much different, right? So last year from January to this time, May, there was probably about 12 fatal shootings. This year, from January to May, there's only been 13. So we're only up one. What I really feel like is heightening the situation is that the world has stopped because of this pandemic. And we're paying a lot more attention. So it really feels like, you know, there's this major uptick. And compared to last year, there really isn't, right? Our world has stopped, but the world of these young people that we service has not. And I feel like we're paying more attention now, right? We're staying at home. We're sitting on our couches. We're watching the news. So it's heightened for us.
That's such a conundrum, Talia, because people who are active in trying to solve community violence and raise awareness of issues are often so frustrated that on a daily basis, the broader community isn't paying attention. And now it took a pandemic to get people to pay more attention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's both a good and bad thing, right? Because then there's all this added pressure on outreach workers, is this added pressure on BPD. But the reality is we really are doing all we can, right? You know, I always say to folks, they're like, you know, outreach workers should deter violence. And I feel like that's an unfair expectation for us. I feel like it's an unfair expectation for BPD, because if we really could, we would, right? So that just shows us that there's just a lot more work that needs to be done to curb violence.
I want to put the economy into this, if it's appropriate to do so. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the thousands of people in Massachusetts who are newly turning to food banks, what hunger looks like.
Yeah.
But there is this larger economic shutdown looming. I know you know Reverend Jeffrey Brown, founder of RECAP, which is Rebuilding Every Community yeah. Around Peace, one of the architects of the Boston Miracle. He said that economics is playing a part like it always does.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the thing. Like, so there have been some communities that have really been hit hard. Obviously, people are losing their jobs. You know, you see reports of people who have never used a food bank using a food bank. But then, you know, I look at our community. I'm looking at Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan with people who are frequently using pantries, the food pantries. So it is obviously, you know, people have lost their jobs. That's an issue. But there are still tons of people in our community who have been without jobs, right? Who didn't have jobs to lose. So that's played a role, but it's played a role well before this pandemic.
And I wonder how to think about the conversations we've been having about how communities of color, low-income communities, have been disproportionately impacted by the virus itself and by the economic blows caused by the virus. What do you think of that in this context?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard. Like, I heard someone say, I think I saw it on Facebook, that social distancing is a privilege. You know, when you live in a household where with a parent, maybe a grandparent, two or three cousins, you know, an uncle who's coming in and out. Like, it's almost impossible to practice social distancing. So it does. It's unfortunate.
What about the curfew, Talia? We know Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has said the curfew is going to continue. There is a curfew in place. The shootings last night happened, I believe, after that time. Is the curfew just not being enforced? Is it not taken seriously? How do we think about that?
Yeah. Well, the curfew is a suggestion, right? It's not mandatory. So that's the first thing. Unfortunately, you just can't control people. People are going to do what they do. And unless we actually mandate the curfew, you know, I feel like we will continue to see people out and about.
So, Talia, there's one more issue I want to bring in, and then I'm going to bring in another voice for a minute. You probably know that Police Commissioner William Gross has repeatedly and pointedly been saying that he's concerned that the policy to do COVID-19 related releases, both of some pretrial detainees and some paroling of some convicted prisoners, could be playing a role here. He posted about that specifically on his first personal Facebook page last night on his way to this scene. We know DA Rachel Rollins isn't convinced. Prior to last night, she had told the Globe none of the individuals involved with violence before last night were COVID-related that they knew of, although there was still some research being done. What role, if any, do you believe this release policy is playing in the violence that we're seeing right now?
It's hard to say one because our department is not specifically looking at that and tracking that data. But obviously, you know, there are young people who have been arrested for firearms and who have been released back into the community. One of the things that we've been working on is really collaborating and coordinating with the DA's office, BPD, so that as these young people are coming home, you know, if we can connect to them, we're trying to. But it's hard. It's a very hard predicament. You know, we certainly don't want anyone to get sick, you know, but at the same time, you know, it's complicated when you're releasing individuals back into the community that have been dangerous and terrorizing our neighborhoods. So it's a very,
so Talia,
it's complicated.
I'm going to ask you to sit tight for just a minute there, because I want to build on that by bringing in another voice, John Feinman, the founder and executive director of Inner City Weightlifting. Inner City Weightlifting is a nonprofit that connects with at-risk men, some of whom may be affiliated or active in gangs or have been formerly incarcerated, connects them with a place to connect, work out, and find jobs. John, welcome. You've been listening in. How are you? And what are you thinking about what you've heard?
I'm doing well, and I think I'm fortunate to say that. Thank you for having me on. I guess what I'm thinking is it comes down to caring for people and valuing people, not just when an event happens that rocks us to a core, but all the moments in between, big and small. And I think until we get there as a society and not just approach issues through a lens of criminality, but instead through a lens of humanity, progress is going to be tough. And there's just so many variables, and it's so nuanced and complicated, but it's got to start with truly valuing people as people.
John, what do listeners today not understand about what's happening in neighborhoods right now that they need to understand?
I think what people need to understand is that these events, they're not just these one-off random acts. There has been systemic inequities and injustices and decades and centuries of trauma that have torn families apart, that have led to disinvestment in communities and devaluing of people and kind of looking at people as others or less than. And until we start to understand the circumstance that led to an event and that person's journey along the way, we're always going to be looking at the surface, and often, even if we're coming from a good intention, the solutions may very well and, in fact, often do perpetuate the very problem we're otherwise seeking to solve.
Talia, what's your reaction to John's comment there?
I mean, I totally agree. You know, we've been working pretty closely with our nonprofit partners like Inner City Weightlifting and Local Boston to really try to strategize to find solutions to some of the issues that John raised.
John, let's talk about programming. I'm assuming you can't run a gym in the same way you did before the COVID-19 crisis. I know that's just one part of what Inner City Weightlifting does. And I understand you're now offering virtual personal group workouts. But how else have you adapted, and how are other programs going to need to adapt in this strange new normal?
Our promise to the people in our program has always been to simply be there for them so they don't have to feel like they have to solve their challenges alone. We try to position ourselves as a partner. And that doesn't change whether you're face-to-face or virtual. There are plenty of challenges in this virtual world. But there's also a lot of opportunity that comes when the in-person restrictions are lifted. And I think that what programs are going to have to do, certainly what we've done, is there's plenty of uncertainty, but to really just lean into the opportunities that are forming by this. So we've restructured our case management. We've kind of created a much tighter protocol, so to speak, for our staff as to what information we're trying to get from the people in our program and their families so we can best position ourselves to leverage our network to connect some of those dots. If it means just making that load just a little bit lighter, that's our goal now. So it's really just leaning into what this current and new world going forward is going to be and leveraging those opportunities.
Talia, Reverend Jeffrey Brown has said that he's optimistic that the city will be able to come together on these issues despite the pandemic, but expressed some concern about whether there will be resources to support the wide range of groups like an Inner City Weightlifting. Here's what he said.
I'm always concerned about the dearth of support that is given to local community groups in order to address the issue of violence, and with the not only this country shutting down, but the state shutting down, it becomes an increasing concern about how we're going to be able to do that.
So, Talia, last question to you. Are there enough resources? Are you concerned about resources right now?
We're we're always concerned about resources. always concerned about resources. And I agree that, you know, there's going to be this increased need from the philanthropic community to help our city rebound.
All right. Well, that's Talia Rivera, Director of Street Outreach, Advocacy and Response for the City of Boston. Talia, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And John Feinman, the founder and executive director of InterCity Weightlifting. John, good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
We've said repeatedly here on the show that the coronavirus pandemic has exposed fault lines of vulnerability in the Commonwealth. Hunger is one of those fault lines. The nonprofit Feeding America predicts that 1 in 8 people in eastern Massachusetts will experience food insecurity this year due to the crisis. When it comes to children, that number increases to 1 in 6. That marks a 59% growth in food insecurity in eastern Massachusetts and a 53% increase across the state. This week, Governor Charlie Baker announced that the state is committing $56 million to support food assistance programs in the Commonwealth.
Our goal is to use this funding to meet a greater demand for nutritional assistance among vulnerable populations and those struggling with the economic impacts of the pandemic.
Catherine D'Amato, CEO of the Greater Boston Food Bank, is on the line with us to help us understand the scope of the problem right now. Welcome, Catherine.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Catherine, sometimes I find like the best question to ask right off the bat is, how bad is it? How big a deal is our hunger problem in the Commonwealth right now?
It's incredibly difficult to give you this number. I mean, you stated it up front in terms of a 59% increase in the most vulnerable that are approaching, you know, looking at food insecurity for a significant long period of time. We just have not seen this kind of, you know, change in food insecurity numbers, not in my lifetime of fighting domestic hunger in this country for nearly 40 years.
Okay, I have to admit, I wasn't expecting you to say something that extreme. I know you know I ran Catholic Charities during the last economic crisis, 2008-2009. We thought that change was really bad. You're saying this outstrips that.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at food security, and you know this well, given your background, it has been a problem in our country for a long, long time. Yet here we now find ourselves in this pandemic. This is like doubling down, Tiziana. Like this is taking 400,000 people and making it 800,000 people. And then it could be even higher because the unemployment numbers continue to grow. And this is that huge uncertainty that all of us are facing. What's the duration of this pandemic and its impact on communities in eastern Massachusetts served by the Greater Boston Food Bank? I mean, there's enormous uncertainty for people. And during this period of time, for however long it lasts, we are going to see significant numbers of families and individuals facing food insecurity for the very first time.
Catherine, we spoke earlier today with Beth Chambers, the director of Catholic Charities Greater Boston, Catholic Charities South, about some of the new faces that they're seeing. Let's listen to a little of that.
We have a number of people who were previously employed and have been furloughed and laid off and are a part of a larger family where they were the breadwinners. And they're saying, look, you know, this is something new for me, but I have to feed my family and at the same time pay my rent and pay my utilities and drive that car I came in here.
That's really an every person experience. Every community has those stories. Are we having a shared hunger experience that is different than those who are usually vulnerable to hunger?
I can't hear you if you're talking.
Oh, I've lost Catherine. Catherine's
no,
lost
I'm right
sound
here.
For me. Okay, I'm great. So did you hear that question, Catherine?
Okay. I did. You were awesome. I heard the question. I heard Beth. I heard everybody. So, So the question I think you're asking is this a new, you know, is this, why is this so new? Maybe I don't have it correct, Tiziana, but what is clear is that because this is such a pervasive pandemic, right? Or because the pandemic is so pervasive, it has touched everyone that we, you know, that everybody's being touched in some way. And the issue of food insecurity has now come from a very hidden, you know, issue to a very visible issue. You cannot turn away when you see reports on national news about lines of cars or lines of people. This is an economic disaster, and it's also a health disaster. But what it has also shown us is that it is a food security disaster as well.
So what do we have to do?
Yeah, well, what we have to do is similar to, you know, we're grateful to the governor, for example. It's the first time in my knowledge that we've had a food security task force put into place to try to respond. The resources that are being delegated and hopefully appropriated are going to make a very big difference across the emergency feeding system. I think we have to stay resilient. This is a long, long recovery. And, you know, we're going to see people for the next 2, 3, 4 years. These jobs are not just going to flip back on or in, and the impact is so significant. And that's where, you know, the issue cannot be turned away in terms of nutritional assistance for our children, for our elders, for our families. So how we do that, how we bring that all together is going to be very significant. So we're going to need help, Tiziana. We're going to need money. We're going to need volunteers and agencies like Catholic Charities and that Beth Tamers. We're going to need them to stay resilient, and we plan to keep that network strong.
You talked about the governor putting together this task force for the first time. I know you know that earlier this week he announced, that the state will commit $56 million to support groups working to address food insecurity. Given the magnitude of what you've just said, is that enough? And given the threats to the state budgets from decreased tax revenues, is it sustainable?
It's never enough. I mean, in my entire career, I've never seen enough because we continue to have food insecurity in our country. It's an absolutely solvable problem. You know, we have the food. We have the places for people to get food. This is much more the economic impact of really showing the ugly side of food inequities and food resources and where they're located in our communities and how people can get them. So the good news, Tiziana, is that it's a start, right? And that there has been for years a network of organizations and donors and food companies that have been in this fight. The key is now we have a bigger problem than we could have ever imagined. So we're going to need to stay resilient and to stay focused. You know, I fully believe that Massachusetts can be a food secure state. I have always believed that. It's absolutely possible. What this pandemic is going to put upon us is that we have to double down. We have to work harder or differently and work with partners like the state in this appropriation that is going to make a significant difference along with private philanthropy.
Catherine, the average listener may not understand the difference between SNAP or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and food assistance, SNAP being financial benefits, money that people can use to buy food, food assistance being actual food. What's the balance and need there? I know that here in the Commonwealth, there's been a 360% increase in SNAP applications since the pandemic began.
Right. So when we think of how can we help people who need food, I'd encourage people to go to our website, gbfb.org, and click on the need food icon. And in there is a list of a lot of options for people. You know, one is here, put in your zip code and you can see what local food pantry exists in your community and it's ours. You know, the second is you can contact Mass 211 across our state and they'll help you with social services. The third is using the Project Bread food source hotline, which is listed there, who can walk you through how to do that SNAP application and help you determine if you're eligible. These are just, you know, key things. And also, you'll be able to see that the 1300 meal programs in school districts across our state that are available. So these sources are all here for people. And SNAP is one of the most effective programs for nutritional assistance that we have in our country. And getting people on SNAP has been a huge difficulty. There's been a big SNAP meal gap. And this pandemic has just pointed people to a federal resource that can help them. And it's my hope that the state will continue to put SNAP as a priority and put more people on board to help process what is, again, this enormous response of people seeking help.
And again, just for our listeners, the website that Catherine mentioned, we'll put it on our website as well, radioboston.org. Catherine, one more thing on SNAP. You know the Commonwealth has received the green light from the USDA this week to participate in a pilot program that would allow people to use SNAP benefits to purchase food online. That hasn't happened before. How important is that?
It's extraordinary. So you know well enough in your policy work that sometimes in the most difficult, strenuous times, we're able to move policies forward that have been, you know, in the queue for years and years and years. This is a perfect example of, because of the difficult times, we're now able to get a policy that people have been fighting for. So it's awesome that people can. Why not? You know, it's the same way of looking at how we got fruits and vegetables into the use of the SNAP program, because it was hard to measure things, or in the WIC program. So it just is, it's really good news. And I hope that individuals and families that are using the SNAP benefits take advantage of these changes in the policy, like the, you know, pandemic EBT card. That's another one that's happening right now. So there are ways in which we can help your listeners get the food they need. Go to gbfb.org. We're here to help you.
And that's Catherine D'Amato, CEO of the Greater Boston Food Bank. Catherine, I really appreciate you giving us time today.
You're welcome.
Secretary of State William Galvin has said he wants to start printing ballots for fall elections as soon as June 2nd. That is next week. You heard that right. September and November elections are right around the corner. They require planning and preparation now, but we're in a pandemic, which raises massive logistical challenges that have to be solved, or not, in order to ensure enfranchisement come fall. What do you think we need to do? Do you want to vote by mail, or are you worried about voter fraud? And how about early voting? Should it be extended to the primaries and maybe a bigger window? Will you vote in person this September if you have to? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by two people who are thinking deeply about this issue. The first is Pam Wilmot, Executive Director of the advocacy group Common Cause Massachusetts. Pam, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you, Tiziana. Pleased to be here.
And I'm glad to have you. And friend of the show, Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, and deputy CEO and general counsel for the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael, welcome back to you too.
Glad to be here.
So Pam, I'm going to start with you. Can you briefly give us a rundown about the types of proposals that are at Beacon Hill right now about preparing for voting in the fall?
Okay. Well, let's just start with where we are. As your previous guest talked about regarding food insecurity, you know, we are on unprecedented times, and COVID-19 has touched us all in one way or another. And that means we need vast changes in the way that we vote. These will happen regardless of whether we change our rules. So we need to be ahead of that. And that's basically that voters should not have to choose between their health and their constitutional right to cast a ballot in November, as well as in the September primary. And the best way to do that is by casting an absentee ballot or a vote by mail ballot. Many other states have much more liberal rules around this. Massachusetts is one of the few that requires an excuse to cast an absentee ballot. We waive
that. What does that mean, Pam? What does an excuse mean?
An excuse is you're supposed to have a physical disability or a religious reason or to be absent from your city or town. So
fear of contagion would not count at this point.
The legislature and Galvin have expanded that for the spring. We think it needs to be expanded for the fall to cover any kind of precautions around COVID-19. So I think that's one area of broad agreement that we need to provide everyone with an excuse, because we all have one at the moment. And a broader, longer term sense, there's just no reason to have such limitations on mail voting in this day and age. Most states have no excuse absentee ballot, and we need to do that in Massachusetts. But
so Pam, I'm just going to interrupt you a little bit. We're going to be cut a little short on time today because we wound up having to cover some breaking news at the end. So let me just ask you if you can just give me a really brief rundown other key bills that are under consideration right now.
Okay, the main question is how are we going to provide those absentee ballots? Are we going to have a request process? Where and how does that request process work? It's currently very cumbersome. Are we going to mail a request form to every voter, or are we going to mail a ballot to every voter? And those are our three policy options. I think another one that's very important is to have an online request portal, which many, many states have. We have online voter registration in this state, and it's not a big change from that. But the big question is, how do you get that ballot? And the reason why this is so important is because we have a very decentralized election system. And we've seen in all the states that have had elections this spring, particularly presidential primaries with, 30%-ish turnout, is the clerks just haven't been able to provide the ballots in time, and the Postal Service has become very slow. So that's why we want to streamline the process and have an online request system, as well as for the general to mail everyone a ballot so that the clerks are not crushed with the kind of work that they have to do in a very short period of time with a 75 to 80% turnout of voters in Massachusetts.
Let's bring Michael Curry's voice in here. Michael, what's at stake?
Yeah, it's funny. We've been advocating for years, many advocacy groups, and I think of Mass Vote, Common Cause, and many others around expanding the franchise, early voting, mail-in voting, making sure that more people can actually participate in the process. And I always think about states. There are five states with universal vote by mail. It means everyone gets a ballot, Utah, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington. And then there are various other versions of that across the country where, as was said, you have to have a reason to vote by mail. And then other states that are open, you can request that. We are in a political year. I mean, every year is political, but I would call it an electoral chess match that's playing out on the federal level and in some states across the country. We are not as much in that challenge here in Massachusetts, but we're a part of the overall overall issue of whether people will participate and the outcome in the primaries and the outcome in November. One of the things that I don't think has been mentioned very much is the fact that we have another challenge with the United States Postal Service. If we do not fund the United States Postal Service beyond September, and there's been issues there, that they will run out of money, particularly in this increased financial challenge that is faced with coronavirus. If they run out of money in September, they won't even have the money to deliver these ballots. So Secretary Galvin has mentioned many of these issues, including the logistical issues. If Congress does not release some estimates as $4 billion, I know the House, the U.S. House was proposing $25 billion in one of the stimulus packages. If they do not provide the funding in a fiscal crisis that we're all facing in all the states across the country, we won't even have the funding to do the kind of work that we need logistically to execute a successful mail-in ballot process here in Massachusetts. So there's a lot of interconnected things on the state and federal level that are playing out. But we may see people not showing up at the polls because they're choosing health over their opportunity to vote.
So Michael, you've said two things there, and I want to bring voices in on both of them. The first is you talked about the logistical challenges, and Pam talked about that as well. Earlier today, we spoke with Democratic State Senator Becca Rausch, who's filed a bill that would mail ballots directly to registered voters for the September primary and the November general election. She says the current system where you have to request a ballot in advance isn't working, and she gave us an example from her own experience with that system.
We're already seeing that not work. My town voted earlier this week, and my spouse and I, we requested our absentee ballots in advance of the deadline. The clerk sent them, and the mail just the mail came late, right? And we also didn't turn in our request, you know, a week early. We turned it in a couple of days early, which was still in advance of the deadline, still timely. So within the last hour of the polls being open, both my husband and I went one at a time to the polls. And that's the exact thing we're trying to avoid, right? The exact thing we're trying to avoid is large crowds at polling places. And that's not safe. And frankly, some people will have to make a choice between voting and their health and safety unless we do something.
So Pam, even if things got passed and we sort of were set up the way we wanted to be set up legislatively, can we actually do it and do it effectively?
We can. I think the real question is still what is going to be passed. Senator Rausch, I think, has a very valid point, and that's why the Election Modernization Coalition, which is comprised of Common Cause and Mass Vote and ACLU and a bunch of other organizations and 120 other endorsing organizations, has recommended mailing people ballots to sort of make that a more efficient process. And there are, you know, it would have to be done by a vendor. They are out there. I've talked to a couple personally. I know some lawmakers have talked to them. It can be done. Will it be seamless? I don't think whatever we do will be seamless. But what we don't want to do is to prevent people from voting or for having huge lines and a huge bloom in COVID-19 like we saw in Wisconsin. I just saw an epidemiological paper about the spike that followed voting very precisely. And that's exactly what we don't want to see. There are solutions to this. I think we can do it. It is a big political change, so that remains to be seen whether we can get that change to the legislature. I'm sure they will do the right thing and advance the ball. It's just a big leap for us. I think we can do it, but it is a big change.
I want to grab a couple of calls here because the other thing that Michael Curry talked about and that we heard there from State Senator Becca Rausch was, okay, we want to avoid people having to go to the polls. But I did ask at the beginning, would you go? And we have a couple of callers who are calling in about that. So we've got Esther on the line from Hopkinton. Esther, go ahead.
Hi there. So I'm going to condense my comments. I think paper ballots should be mailed to everyone, not an application for a ballot, the actual ballot mailed to every registered voter. And even if that doesn't come to pass, there is nothing that will stop me from going to the polls to vote this year.
Thanks, Esther. I appreciate that. Thank you. And Jack from Groton, add your voice.
I think I'm right with Esther there. I will go to the polls to vote if I have to, but I've asked for a mail-in ballot, and that's what I would prefer. I resent the idea that I have to make a choice between my health and my vote. And I want to sort of comment on a social media post I saw of Ted Cruz is showing people standing in line for some, I don't know, maybe some retail operation. And he said, well, if people can do this, then he showed a picture of polling, then people can do this, where polls are separated. I think that's, I resent that someone would make that comparison. The idea that I can go stand in line for a hamburger, I should be able to go vote. They are not at all the same thing. And to make that equivalency is just demonstrates an extraordinary lack of touch with the issue and the way this issue impacts lots of people and the decisions they make.
Thanks for that call, Jack. So Michael Curry, Jack puts it in stark comparison, right? A vote is not a hamburger. And actually, it's kind of not a bad way to think about it. But this is a political issue. Why is this politicized?
I mean, I think that's the times we're in. You know, it's what we're seeing across the country where people don't want to recognize that there is even a virus spreading, that there's a pandemic, and people are choosing along party lines not to put a mask over their face to sort of align themselves with the party or the president. We're the only word I can use is toxic times where people would choose to be political over their own personal health. I think it was well said about Wisconsin, the seven or so individuals who arguably got infected while they came to vote in Wisconsin. And of course, we know what they call the R factor, that once you're infected, you're spreading that, especially if you're not tested and you're not contact trace that spreads. So we have a challenge in this country right now. Do we want to be hyper-partisan the detriment of our own health? I'm concerned for those two callers that if they choose to exercise the franchise and show up to vote because they know of the importance and credit to them, that hopefully, by God, they don't have chronic conditions and they don't fall into a high-risk category that puts them at great risk. It is a life or death decision whether you're grabbing a hamburger or going to vote.
So, Michael, I hear you loud and clear on that, and I want to turn to Pam here. This has broken down across party lines, and the Republican argument has been the exposure to potential fraud. I understand that the data does not support wide-scale voting fraud attempts and successes in the country. Common sense does say that a piece of paper that arrives privately and is executed privately and sent back privately versus at a polling place, common sense says that does seem like it would increase the likelihood that something could be done fraudulently. So what about that?
Well, first I would point out that vote by mail and voting over the mail has never, until this moment, been a big partisan issue. Utah isn't exactly a bright blue state. It's a bright red state. And the Republican Party in many places have been pushing this reform. People who vote by mail beforehand tend to be older and whiter and more Republican. So it's just the moment that we are in. And in fact, as you said, the studies are very clear. There is no increase in voter fraud. And in fact, there's lots of protections that are in place. Each ballot has a code. It is tracked to a particular person. You can actually go online and track to see where it is. The signatures are matched at some point. There's a process by which you can cure that if there's an issue. It has worked very well for people of both parties and elected candidates from both parties. So,
Michael Curry,
the president voted himself by mail, as well as the vice president.
And I would just add places like Arizona in 2018, 79% did so. So it's not like we haven't been here before. And we're challenged as Americans, quite frankly, the world right now, with embracing new ways of doing old things, whether it's telehealth or how do we provide Chromebooks to students. We are also challenged on how we provide our electoral participation. And it is about evolving around early voting, around mail-in ballots, and whether we embrace that or not is really going to be the question.
So Pam and Michael, we have 30 seconds total left. So just very briefly from each of you, will the state house pass legislation? Will we have changes in the fall? Yes or no? Pam?
Absolutely. There will be huge changes. Exactly how far they go, I think, remains to be seen, but the legislation is being worked on now. We will see some things moving very quickly. We have been working very hard to encourage politicians to really embrace the moment and to do what needs to be done to protect our voters and allow for participation.
And Michael Curry.
Yeah, and I would say we always forget to give credit to the advocates, and she mentioned a lot of them. Credit to them. They laid the foundation for this. Now we just got to walk through the door. Yes, I believe it'll get done. I believe Senator Crean, Representative Madero, and others have really been fighting the fight. Galvin seems moving on this as well. So I think the stars may be aligning. Quite frankly, this is one of those times you're just thankful that you live in Massachusetts and not in one of these other swing states.
All right. That's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and deputy CEO and general counsel for the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
And Pam Wilmot, executive director of Common Cause Massachusetts. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
We found out today that the September rescheduled Boston Marathon has been canceled, first time in the race's 124-year history. WBUR's Alex Ashlock, our resident Boston Marathon reporter and the one who was with us when we found out about the reschedule, joins us now in the studio to talk about what we found out today. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me. You only have me on when we're talking about things that aren't happening. I hope we sometime get to talk about the marathon when it does happen, but maybe that won't be until 2021.
I know. And Alex, I know how important the marathon is to you. I'm sorry it's not happening.
Yeah, it's a disappointing announcement. But to be honest, I'm not surprised that they made this decision. It just seemed like, the trends weren't going exactly in the right way. And how do you bring 30,000 people together and a million spectators together safely? We don't know when something like that will be able to happen again.
Alex, this news is only a little more than an hour old. The reporting's been a little confusing about who actually did make the decision. Was it the BAA, the Boston Athletic Association, or Mayor Marty Walsh? What do we know?
You know, it is a little bit confusing. I had trouble sorting it out myself. So Mayor Walsh said that the Boston Athletic Association, with the city's input, determined that running the race this year was just not feasible for public health reasons. So we see Mayor Walsh and we see Tom Grilk of the BAA as sort of the public faces of the marathon, but there are so many other people and communities, you know, behind the marathon, all the cities and towns that the race goes through. You've got the state, you've got the Massachusetts State Police. They're all involved in the marathon because it's such a huge logistical event. But it comes down to, I think, the mayor and the BAA getting together, assessing what's going on, and coming to the decision that, as I said, it's just not feasible, or they said, it's just not feasible for public health reasons to hold this huge mass participation event in September.
So what are we going to do instead, Alex? What's going to happen?
Well, they're going to do this virtual marathon. They're going to set up. Races have done this. You can run the race on your own in a virtual sense, and you know you're still going to get a T-shirt and maybe even some sort of finisher's medal. I think Tom Grilk of the BAA said we can't bring the world to Boston with runners from all over the world coming to Boston for the marathon, but we can bring Boston to the world with this virtual event. So that's going to happen in the first week or two of September. They're going to organize this virtual race.
So what does that mean for the runners, Alex, and what are you hearing from them?
Yeah, I've heard from a few runners this afternoon, and I think they're like me. It's sad, but they're also not shocked that this decision was made. The race got rescheduled at one point. That was about a month ago, more than a month ago, actually. And, you know, we've continued to follow this pandemic. It hasn't really stopped. So they're sad. They're disappointed. But again, they're not shocked. One thing I would say is, you know, when the race was rescheduled from April to September, everybody that was registered and in the race automatically got moved into the September race. But now the race is being pushed back to 2021. So you're not automatically qualified or entered in the 2021 race. So people are going to have to, they can use their qualifying time for this year, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get into the race. So there's just still a lot of uncertainty around this whole story.
Yeah. Well, we're going to continue to watch it. And as you say, hopefully next time we talk about it, it'll be because it is happening.
I hope
that's
so.
WBUR's
I guess that'll be April
Alex
next
Ashlock.
Year. Thank you.
That's right. Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.